to episode 3 of the Dearer Morby Film Podcast. I'm joined, as always, by Rowan Morby.
Hello, everybody.
And I'm Martin Deer. We're going to be talking today. Our primary topic is going to be the just absolute peak of cinema, Michael Bay. We'll obviously be talking about what we've been watching. Today we're also going to be starting, we're going to be making our way through the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die book. From Jason Solomons. The reason this podcast sort of came about is I wanted to sort of delve in more into more classic and foreign cinema, and because we've started this now, I've had this book sat here for a couple of months and never started working my way through it. So it seems like a good time to dive in. Rowan's looking forward to it too, and we do encourage you to sort of join along with us. So we'll be looking at about 2 films every week from the book. Won't be following it all the way through in chronological order. We'll jump through decades, so we cover more recent films in a couple of weeks, and then we'll jump back in time just to keep things sort of fresh. So we'll go jump straight to Rowan. What have you been watching this week that's of any interest?
Well, following last week's podcast, I jumped straight into Apollo 13 last Sunday.
Ah, yes.
Your recommendation. Obviously, I've seen it only once before. I think I might have mentioned that last week. But it's absolutely superb, as you quite rightly said. It's fantastic, fantastic entertainment. Yeah, I mean, I give it I think it's a near-perfect film. Like a 4.5 out of 5 for me. It's superb. You know, as you mentioned last week about the final couple of minutes when their descent to Earth, the way it's edited, it's so tense because you know what's going to happen because it's based on a true story. But the way that Ron Howard creates that suspense and that tension from something, how you know it's going to end, is really genius. Classic Tom Hanks in that period where he could do no wrong for 5 or 6 years back in the 90s, just great film after great film after great film. Apollo 13 is right up there, I think, with his best and Ron Howard's best. Really, really strong film.
Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. I do love it. Yeah, so those final few minutes, it's all supported by just such a great supporting cast.
Mm-hmm.
All the way through the film. To really sell, you know, all the NASA people, they really sell that. I mean, I can't remember the guy's name, the actor who wears the glasses, short, bald. He's the one who tells them to shut down the fuel cells. And, you know, he's only got a couple of lines throughout the film, but even he, so you really feel his sort of stress and anxiousness. So, yeah, pretty great supporting cast from Ed Harris, all the way down to people who've just got, you know, one or two lines. So, mm-hmm. And they really help sell those final moments. So yeah, is a fantastic film.
I watched, just look at my list here before that. I almost think I watched it, to be honest. I watched Killing Season, that new one with De Niro and Travolta.
Oh yeah.
It's pretty, pretty poor, to be honest. I know everyone said it's really weak, but I wanted to check it out because, you know, I like both actors, even though they don't really do many good films these days. But it's crap, to be honest. I can't recommend it. I'm not even going to talk about it too much. It's very, very forgettable. So stay well away of Killing Season. I read that it was supposed to be Nick Cage and John Travolta, you know, teaming up the face-off stars. But that never happened for one reason or another. So they got De Niro in, but I don't think, you know, De Niro, Cage, or doesn't matter who you got in there with that script. It's it was always going to lose.
Pretty terrible then.
Yeah, it is. It's an awful one. I did 4 Stanley Kubricks. I started from the beginning, so Fear and Desire, which is the only one of his I've not seen up until this week. His first movie. It's only an hour long. It's very amateur, obviously very low budget. Decent story. It shows flashes of the stuff that was to come, but it's not like anything else he directed thereafter. But I think it is worth watching if you're going to do a Stanley Kubrick season like I am, in chronological order, you know, to start with that one. I watched Killer's Kiss, The Killing, and Paths of Glory. Killer's Kiss, absolutely superb film, only 1 hour and 7 minutes, but it's a really, really good film noir. Fantastic rooftop chase at the end. Great black and white photography, really good movie. And then you've got The Killing and Paths of Glory, which are two straight up 5-star, 10 out of 10 pictures. If I was to make a list of my top 100 films of all time, I would consider putting them both in there.
I've never seen either of those two, but
really,
I think we'll have to cover, I mean, we'll obviously cover Kubrick at one point.
And I was going to say, yeah, I think, you know, Kubrick will definitely be someone we talk about, so I won't go into these into too much detail. But The Killing is one of the best heist movies you will ever see. It's so good. And Paths of Glory, again, one of the best war movies you'll ever watch. Just both superb pictures. I watched them on the Criterion DVD when Amazon had their sale a couple of weeks ago. I ordered a few Criterions and got both of those for you through. So next up will be Spartacus for me, but I'm going to have to trying to find 3 hours to watch the movie proved difficult this weekend. But yeah, as I say, I'm sure we'll touch on Kubrick in the coming episodes. What about you, Martin? I'll give you a chance to speak. What about you, mate?
Well, I tried to watch as many first watches as possible this week.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I started the bank holiday with Apocalypse Now. On the morning,
you'd book. Boom.
Yeah, you'd got me in the mood to watch that again. I should have watched the Redux because I hadn't seen that version, but I didn't really have the time. You know, I wanted to get a few more films in, so I just went for the normal version, and then I jumped straight into Primer, which was the first watch.
Okay.
For me, I'm gonna need to check this out again soon. I really enjoyed it. I love time travel movies. They're definitely my favorite sort of genre of movie. Anything involving time travel really gets my interest. Did you get a chance to rewatch that this week? I know you said you might do because we were going to
Primer.
Yeah,
I didn't. No,
because there's some really interesting sort of time travel aspects, but there's a lot to take in, especially towards the sort of and the final act.
Yeah, big time.
It always it takes like a bit of a shift in how mental it sort of ramps it up.
Yes, it's definitely a film you have to pay attention to, for sure.
Definitely warrants a couple of rewatches.
Absolutely. Have you seen Upstream Colour yet, by the way?
I haven't, no.
That's a good one. That is, again, it's a sort of movie that requires you to really give it full attention. I watched it, not this week, a couple of weeks ago, but I'm going to have to give that another rewatch before I can fully comment on it, to be honest, because there's a lot going on in that film as well. I think you'll like it.
Yeah, I feel the same about Primer. Like, what do you really? I don't know what I'm really. My feelings are on the film because I need to watch it again just to pick up on all the sort of the time travel elements and what was going on. But yeah, I mean, really enjoyable. Very interesting story. There's very eerie sort of presence throughout the film.
Yeah.
There's a strange undertone that, you know, sort of puts you on edge. Mm-hmm. But yeah, pretty great film. And then I watched that on Netflix. So yes. One of the suggestions to watch next was that Time Crimes, this is a 2007 film.
Time Crimes?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with it.
It's a Spanish film from 2007. And I'd seen a few people talking about it recently for some reason, and then Luke, the co-editor of Film Expression, he was tweeting about it, and I asked him what he thought of it, and he liked it. So I pretty much jumped straight into that straight after Primer, and that's another time travel story, and it was really interesting at the start. Sort of lost its way at the end. What happens is the guy avoids. any sort of major spoilers. Can't really talk about the plot at all, really, without spoiling it. But the first act, you've got a real sort of horror element to it. A guy sees a guy sat in his garden with his wife, and he sees a woman undressing in the woods. They were living in a wooded area, and he sees a woman undressing in the woods. And she, you know, looks sort of under duress, so he goes into the woods to investigate to make sure, you know, she's okay. Comes across a lying down, you know, unconscious, and then is startled by a man wearing his, you know, a long trench coat. He's got a knife, and his face is all bandaged up with blood on it. And then from there, there's like a real sort of horror film, horror element to it. It was really creepy. Really, I mean, the design of that guy with the bandages is very creepy. He, you know, he's chasing this guy through the woods, and it's got a time travel element on it. And it's pretty interesting. It's definitely worth a watch. I thought it lost us, felt it sort of lost its way towards the end, but very interesting use of time travel and the concept there. So definitely worth a watch.
Oh, I will do. I'll make a note of that one.
And I watched Zack and Miri Make a Porno. That was my girlfriend's choice when we were chilling out during the week. But I also watched Bernie.
Hey, good.
That was a first watch. Really enjoyed it. Jack Black is pretty great.
Yeah, he is,
in
isn't
that.
He?
It's a really fun film. I mean, obviously, it gets very strange. But just a really fun film. And I must have missed at the start that it was based on a true story.
Okay.
I must have blinked and and not seen that it was based on a true story, because obviously when at the end, when you sort of, you see the real life Bernie, I was like, oh, well, that makes a bit more sense now. But yeah, really enjoyable film. Black's just outstanding. I love the sort of documentary type feel to it.
Yeah,
but it was just a very fun film.
I remember when I talked about it on the Flicker and Myth podcast a couple of months ago. The bit that I really liked is the talking heads. You assume they're actors, but at the end you then realise no, they are the real townsfolk.
Yeah,
I think that's really really well done. I mean, I don't know, maybe other people assume that all along. I don't know if you thought, but to me, I thought they were just actors.
I thought they were just actors, yeah. I thought they were just actors. But yeah, really interesting way to do it.
Yeah, not a synth or technique before, as far as I'm aware. But yeah, it's like, you know, Richard Linklater, who directed one of our favourite series, the Before series, Ethan Hawke. You know, just again, just doing something completely different. You know, he loves challenging himself. He's not sticking to the same old formula. Even with, I guess, the Before series, you know, yeah, they are, it's a three-part series, but, you know, they're very, very different, aren't they? You're not just cashing in on the success.
No, yeah, they
of,
are. Yeah. I've not seen Before Midnight yet. I didn't get a chance to go and see it. The closest sort of cinema to me playing it was an hour away, so I didn't.
You've not seen it?
No, I kept trying to make, it was going to be like, you know, a three-hour round trip car journey. To see it, and I you know, I was determined to see it, but every sort of Saturday and Sunday I was putting aside. I was thinking during the week I'll go and see it this weekend, I'll go and do it, and then something always came up or that stopped me, so I haven't seen it yet. So
it's a shame. I was sure you'd seen it. Oh well, you know, you gotta pre-order that shit on Amazon, man. You gotta get that. I need to come for your front door on release day.
We'll cover it when it does come out. We'll see. I think we'll probably cover that in a That'll be a franchise we can look at.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, and what else did I watch? I watched Contagion for the first time yesterday.
Yeah. Thoughts?
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed the start. I liked how that sort of played out, as if it was a news report at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, you know, I didn't like the way it wrapped itself up. I thought it was all a bit too neat. You know, there's a real panic and terror at the start. A real good look at sort of how we'd react. And I just thought by the end, it kind of wrapped itself up very neatly.
You know, my thoughts on that film. I say my thoughts on that film. I've only seen it once. I saw it at cinema. Was that, yeah, good movie. I think there's too much going on for the running time, and I felt that it would have made a perfect like 3-part HBO series. You know, an hour and a half each or something. Really flesh it out. You could have, you know, Soderbergh directing, but really, really flesh it out. Whereas I thought the actual running time of the movie was just, I don't know, I think it could have lost the story to be a bit tighter.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, yeah. Probably the Jude Law part.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that really added much.
Well, maybe
I guess it was saying a lot about, I guess it's probably more, you know, online blogging and what, how much shit, you know, sort of comes out online.
Yeah.
And we've seen it recently with movies in the past couple of weeks, haven't we?
Exactly, yes.
So, big time. I guess that's, you know, that actually does have something to say a little bit, so maybe not get rid of that bit. But yeah, it just felt like at the end it did sort of fall apart, whereas the start was really interesting.
Yeah.
And then tracking down the disease and its origin. And the Marion Cotillard, that's probably the part that could...
That's the part that needs to go, yeah.
Yeah, because that just ends so strangely. It doesn't really add anything to the film at all.
No, I agree with you.
And the way, you know, that her story ends, I thought was really odd. Really odd. Obviously, too many spoilers, but... the way she just runs off and then there's no follow-up to that.
No.
To see what happens. So, yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it. It's a good film.
I watched Snake Eyes, Nicolas Cage, Brian De Palma movie. I've seen it many, many times, but I really like it. I watched it because I watched Passion last week and I hated that. And I wanted to revisit some departments. So Snake Eyes was the first one. Plus, it's only 90 minutes. And I could squeeze it in on Thursday night. But if for nothing else... Have you seen it, by the way?
I haven't, no.
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. You should watch it, because if for nothing else, the opening 12 minutes is a piece of genius. It's a single tracking shot. I think there's hidden edits in there, but you don't notice them. You can't notice them, but I think there must be. And it is so, 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 so good, because De Palma, because it's set inside a boxing arena. There's like a big heavyweight championship going on, and there's an assassination attempt during this boxing match. And this way, he takes you through the underbelly of the arena from top to bottom. He shows you all the principal cast. You understand about the lead character, Nicolas Cage. He shows you the assassination. You see all this stuff. He's showing you everything. And then the rest of the film is all about piecing it together. So what did you see and what really happened? What did you hear and what were they really saying? All those sort of things. But it's, yeah, you can find this opening online on YouTube, I'm sure. I'll send you a link to it afterwards, but you've got to watch it because it is brilliant camera work. It's genius. You know, regardless of what people might think about the rest of the movie, and it does end weakly, I won't deny, but you've got to see it just for that alone. It's really, really good.
Cool. Sounds good. I'm just having a look to see if it's on Netflix, actually. Yeah, got anything else?
Yeah, I watched... Pain and Gain, which we'll get to later, because it's Mr. Michael Bay. So I'll touch on that later. And I also watched, actually today, I watched Red Dragon, the Hannibal Lecter movie, 2002, because I've just read the book. I want to work my way through that series of books. And it's really good. I mean, I like the movie anyway. I think it's a seriously good thriller. Really, really good. Great cast. Really well directed by Brett Ratner. I know
That's
he
the
gets a lot.
prequel, right?
It is, yeah. Because it was made by Michael Mann in 86 under the title of Manhunter, which I'm going to watch tonight. So I'll talk about that next week. But obviously that wasn't Anthony Hopkins. Then you know, they made Silence of the Lambs. And of course, that became an iconic character and an acting performance by him. They made Hannibal. And then on the success of that, they remade Red Dragon again, but with Anthony Hopkins playing Hannibal Lecter this time again. It's really, really good. I say, you know, I know Brett Ratner gets a lot of shit from people for being just not a good director, but I don't think he's anywhere near as bad as a lot of people make out. And Red Dragon, I think, is a genuinely, genuinely good thriller. I like it a lot, and it also sticks closely to the book, really closely, which I was very impressed with. So, yeah, good movie, great book, good movie. And I'll talk about Manhunter next week.
Brilliant. Well, before we sort of move on, I watched Jaws this morning.
Oh, say no more.
It was my 200th film of the year, so I thought it's got to be something special, so I whacked Jaws on.
Boom.
I got the Steelbook, which is just, you know, as glorious as the film looks on Blu-ray. It really does look stunning on Blu-ray.
Yeah, I got the Blu-ray. I've not watched it yet.
You need to do that. It looks amazing.
So I got the Digibook version.
Ah, yes, that's a nice looking set.
Yes, very nice. The only reason I haven't watched it yet because I saw it at the cinema last year because they re-released it on digital. And I saw it then, so I just haven't been. I guess I haven't been ready to revisit it, even though you know you don't need to be ready to revisit a fantastic film like that. But
the Prince Charles are showing it this month as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, got quite a few Spielbergs on.
But it's ridiculous, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just amazing how. You know, it's one of the best horror films you'll ever see.
Yeah.
It's you know what was probably the origin of the blockbuster.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't see the shark for a good long while, but you know the way he constructs the scenes and builds the tension. The film's still terrifying.
Yeah. It's a genuine masterclass in suspense, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Backed up by a lot of it's a really really smart film as well.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of modern a lot Spielberg gets a lot of stick for sort of brokering in the blockbuster, but this is just a smart film. You know, it's so far removed from the blockbusters we get today. Any sort of criticisms of that is just, it's ridiculous. Just a very smart film.
I don't know who would be making criticisms about the brilliance of Jaws in comparison to the crap we get today. I mean, just because Jaws was so successful has no linkage as to why we're getting shit like Elysium. I'm sorry, but, you know, Steven Spielberg's brilliance has no relationship to the crap that's being churned out today.
No, I mean, you do see it, though. I've seen quite a bit of it online. It's online. There's a lot of shit out there, but
there is indeed.
You know, it's just a really smart film. It's got characters who are fully fleshed out, all very interesting. Quint, Rhodey, and Hooper, just three very interesting characters. It's got such iconic scenes.
Yeah,
you know the Indianapolis story. The smile, you son of a bitch. The first shot, the first attack right at the start. Just so many iconic moments throughout the film. Just utterly fantastic. And a lot of people say the shark looks bad. I don't think the shark looks that bad.
No, I've never done really. I think it's obviously there's a couple of scenes towards the end. I think when it starts.
When it jumps on the boat, that looks bad.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a bit. But
I don't think it looks that bad at all.
No, I mean, I'd rather see that than a CGI shark.
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. No problems about that. I'd rather see that than the CGI shark any day of the week. And
And
you
there's
know,
sorry, go on.
I'm saying if they made that film today, I mean, I know this is all nonsense, but if, let's say, Jaws were made today, you would see that shark within the first 30 minutes, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You'd see it, and you'd see it again, 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 and by the end, there'd be nothing left to see. But Spielberg, he shows you glimpses, and then at the end, he shows you everything. And by that point, you're gagging to see what this thing looks like. It's been built up so much from talk and just little glimpses, and when you finally see how the scale of it, it's a fantastic payoff.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And like some of the when you finally do begin to see the shark in sort of all its glory, there's some great shots when the shark, when the shark comes under the boat and you see the whole size of it, and you see it quite clearly under the water. I mean, that the cinematography in this is absolutely gorgeous. There's
It's amazing.
I mean there's so many beautiful shots. A lot of it's set at dusk and at dawn, the twilight. Just looks absolutely stunning. There's a shot of Quint where he's out on the whatever the technical term is for the bit that points out at the end of the boat, and he's silhouetted against the dusk, and it just looks, it's an incredible shot. It just all looks pretty, it all looks stunning. And I know it was obviously done in post, but the image of Rhodey and Hooper in frame as the shooting star goes across.
Oh yeah.
That looks great.
Yeah, it's just an absolute, it's a stunning, stunning film. It really is.
Yeah, I love the way Spielberg, he makes, especially when it comes to Rhodes, Chief Brody, he I mean, that first shark attack on the beach when the camera closes in closer. Such great use of the camera work in the film. You really feel the closing of Brody's chest as things begin to go wrong.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. And speaking of another horror of horrors, I saw Your Next on Friday.
Oh dear.
Thought it was pretty poor.
I've only heard of it. I mean, me personally, I don't watch hardly any other modern horror films. So all these ones that come out, I just have little to no interest in them. But I've heard it's horrendously acted.
Yeah, it's. I don't. I'm not understanding the love for it that I've seen. It's obviously it's a home invasion movie, and it starts off, very creepy. They build it. They build up sort of the suspense about what's going on because there's an attack on a house before the main house where it all plays out. And the design of these characters wearing these wolf masks, these animal masks, very creepy. It builds the sort of suspense up very well about what's to come. But once the attack comes on the house, it just loses any sort of feeling of suspense and slow build, and just then it just becomes an excuse to see screwdrivers being shoved into
Oh
someone's
God.
chest, and it just becomes about gore really,
Yeah.
rather than telling an interesting story. Which it had good promise at the start. It just wants that first attack. Once the attack comes on the main house, it just descends into pointless gore, really. It's a shame. So yeah,
Yeah.
I didn't think much of that at all, really.
So, I mean, I say I'll never watch it, but I saw the trailer at the cinema last week, and it's got to be the worst trailer I've ever seen. They play that song "Perfect Day" over images of people getting chased and hit with axes. I'm like, well, really? Is that the best you could come up with?
Well, I liked the trailer actually.
Did you? Oh man.
I thought it looked all right. Which is why I saw it, and obviously everyone sort of raving about it online. I thought I'd check it out, but it was pretty much a waste of time, really. So yeah, anything else of note that you've seen before we sort of move on?
Don't think so, but so we'll talk about a couple of others in our next section. But I think that was pretty much it. Yeah, done.
Okay, so we'll move on to the next segment of the show, which is, we've titled it Journey Through Cinema. And we'll be looking at the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die book, which you can find online quite easily if you want to take a look. Well, the reason for this segment of the show is when I came up with the idea of the podcast and spoke to Rowan about doing it, is it was really about me getting to see more classic and foreign films that I wouldn't necessarily sort of go out of my way to always watch, but I, you know, want to watch, and this sort of forces me into doing it now, and just to discuss it with Rowan and just to understand more, you know, get to know more about the art that I love, really. So that's the whole reason for this, and we'll be looking at, you know, all these films moving through the decades to see where, you know, see where film come from and where we are now. So today we'll be looking at two films which you can very easily find. They're on YouTube. They are George Méliès's A Trip to the Moon from 1902 and The Great Train Robbery from 1903. Now, these films are highlighted as sort of landmark films for the art. And we'll start with A Trip to the Moon, which is it's a French film. It's Le Voyage dans la Lune is its French title. For anyone who's seen Hugo, you'll be probably aware of this film if you weren't already. So Ben Kingsley played George Méliès, the director, in that film. I'll read a quick excerpt from the 1001 book. When thinking about A Trip to the Moon, one's mind is quickly captured by the original and mythic idea of early filmmaking as an art whose rules were established in the very process of its production. This French movie was released in 1902 and represents a revolution for the time, given its length, approximately 14 minutes, as compared to the more common 2-minute short films produced at the beginning of the last century. So yeah, first watch for this for me today, and I really enjoyed it. It was... It's described as probably the first sci-fi film, and a lot of sort of films around this time, before this film, were more sort of films about daily life, whereas this was George Méliès, you know, opening his mind and being creative and expressing that and telling a film that had never really been seen before. And it's very interesting to see sort of these elements which you'll come to see in sci-fi for decades to come. The film is about a group of scientists who decide they want to travel, go to the moon. And the scientists, you know, they build a rocket, they end up going to the moon. We've all seen that very iconic shot of the moon with the face on it with the rocket which lands into it. When they get there, they find a race of people on the moon. So there's always sort of things which you'll come to see in sci-fi for decades to come, with, you know, our obsession with space travel and discovering new worlds, and alien beings which, you know, are a threat to us. I'll jump it over to you, Rowan, to sort of get your thoughts in. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed this film. It's only 14 minutes long, but it felt longer when I was watching it. It's because so much is packed into it. You know, it's just a single camera, single mise-en-scene. There's no speech cards either, so you never have any. There's no dialogue whatsoever. It's all just a musical score. But it's genuinely, how should I say, it's genuinely exciting, I think, to watch this movie, which, you know, 110 years old now. But to think, you know, he didn't have any, I guess he didn't have anything to copy or to draw inspiration from, you know, it within the medium of film. And you think that, wow, this all came from this one guy's imagination. even with the like I guess what you might call matte paintings or the scenery, considering, you know, when it was made, it looked really, really good. And I can only imagine, you know, people watching this for the first time back then, how stunned they must have been, and how exciting and, you know, adventurous it must have been to watch this, to watch, you know, this film about these guys going to another planet and exploring it, and that fantastic shot you talk, you know, you mentioned about the rocket landing in the eye of the moon. Just amazing. And here I am, you know, today, 2013, really excited watching it. And you can only imagine what it must have been like back then. It's really, really good. There's no question about it. How they did it all back then, I really don't know.
You say it's really, I mean, we get sort of excited now when we see, when we watch... When we watch these films, you know, these days, you know, I loved, sort of the set design in Man of Steel for Krypton, and how they built this whole new world. And that's very exciting to me. As all sci-fis that come out, I'll be, you know, we're marveled at how filmmakers, how they build these new strange worlds. And we get excited by them despite having seen, you know, countless number of sci-fi films. That all, you know, build their own worlds, but it's still so exciting. But for, you know, as you say, for these people to back in 1902 to see a film which explored, which told a story of exploring a new world, and really, you know, I mean, to sit there and see a film where, you know, they go to the moon. I mean, to be an audience member there must have been absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
To experience that.
I was going to say, even some of the, I guess what you call it, the special effects are pretty damn good, because he hits these alien creatures with his stick, and they just disappear in a puff of smoke. I think it looks really good. And, you know, he puts his umbrella in the ground, and then there's a quick cut, and it grows into a mushroom. But, you know, the mushroom is the exact same shape as the umbrella. It's just... The attention to detail is really genuinely impressive. I can't really praise it enough. It's just, I think it's a film where everyone has got access to it now because it's on YouTube. But there's a colour and a black and white version. I watched both. I read about the restoration of the colour version and how, you know, each frame was painted by hand. What do you think? That's quite incredible. Even back then, to, you know, paint all those frames of film back by hand, and then when they restored it, I don't know what year it was, you know, to go back and do it again. Just really, really impressive piece of filmmaking. And also it makes sense. I mean, I don't want to say, oh, just because it was made 100 years ago, I expect it to not make sense. Of course not. That's nonsense. Because a lot of films today don't make sense. But considering, you know, this could easily have been a mishmash of images because it was just exploring, you know, film. But no, not at all. It tells a story from beginning to end. The scientists, they sit in a room. They discuss what they're going to do. We're going to go to the moon. You see them building the rocket. You see them having their farewell. You see them on the moon, exploring, they get captured, they escape, they come back, they land in the sea, they have their welcome home party. You know, it's everything's there. It's a genuinely good story. And the sort of thing, you could take that story today, you know, give it to some studio and $200 million, and you could make the same movie, you know, the same story, you know? It's Yeah, superb. Absolutely superb.
Yeah, like some of the things I sort of loved about it that jumped out to me. I mean, we both just watched Apollo 13 recently. You know, you mentioned it earlier. And you've got that... There's that iconic shot of the moon in this film, but then there's also a great shot of the scientist watching the Earth,
Yes.
sunset from the moon, and that's, you know, that's fantastic. I mean, like, you look at the first images, you know, the first pictures taken of the Earth from space, you know, that iconic shot, the blue marble, and like in Apollo 13, you get the same image of Earth when they come around the moon, you know, and the Earth dawn. And here in this film in 1902, you've got, you know, we're so fascinated by, you know, the world that we live in, that, you know, seeing a very primitive form of, you know, the Earth in that film, and setting from the moon, you know, that was just utterly fantastic.
I love the way that how the scenery is pulled down, and how the earth is obviously risen up. And I liked it. I liked it how the scientists wave at the earth as well. I thought that actually made me laugh. Just imagine them waving at their friends back home. I thought that was a nice little touch.
It's pretty sweet. It's like, it feels like a very honest film. You know, this is you know, the goal is simply to tell a story which will capture people's minds, and it still felt like that, you know, today, 111 years later, you know, to watch this now, through my, I watched it on my laptop through my TV connected by a HDMI lead. This 10-minute film from 1902, and yeah, it's still pretty captivating to watch it.
It is. It really is.
So yeah, that was a really enjoyable film. I do recommend checking it out. As Rowan said, there's a colour version. They're both on YouTube. They're both available. There's a couple more of George Méliès's films which I'm gonna check out on YouTube. There's one called An Impossible Journey, which came out in 1903 and is also considered a, you know, sort of a landmark science fiction film. So I'm definitely gonna check out. You know, I saw Hugo last year. But you know, I never really followed that up to check out Méliès's films. But you know, now having watched this and driving myself to do it, I think I'll be checking out a couple of more in the weeks to come. So yeah, really interesting to see this, you know, where I guess where the sort of modern creative type of filmmaking come from started, really. It's pretty great. So the and then the second film which we watched was the 1903 film The Great Train Robbery, directed by Edwin S. Porter, considered as, what, you know, the first Western film, you know, long before that genre of film became, you know, became so huge. This was made by the Edison Company in November 1903, and it tells the story of, again, it's around 10, 12, 30 minutes long, and it tells the story of three criminals who rob a train. And I thought it was really, the way the story is sort of works in this film, it feels very different whilst having a lot of sort of the same techniques, because, you know, it's the same, you know, the same time period. But it felt very different to A Trip to the Moon, in the way it was shot, and the way they tell the story. You know, there's in A Trip to the Moon, there's not really much of a narrative as narrative as we sort of come to think of it now. But it felt like in the Great Train Robbery, there was more of sort of a complete story, you know, from them, from the initial first scenes where they get a controller to sort of send a message out to stop the train, which is how they end up robbing it, through to their spoiler, sorry, their capture later on. It feels like a much more sort of complete film. And again, very, very interesting to watch this film. They, I had a mind blank there. Rowan, jump in.
I think I can edit that. Yeah, you know, the first off, you think we just watch a sci-fi and a Western, and you know, both genres still very much going strong today. And I guess, you know, both genres have got these two films to thank, because you say the trip to the moon was fun and jovial and obviously very, very light-hearted, whereas the Great Train Robbery is genuinely dark. You know, it's a dark film. It people get shot, people die. There's a scene on top of the train, and I was watching. I actually said to myself, "Bloody hell!" Because it could he stones that bloke to death on top of the train and chucks him off. I thought, "Bloody hell, that is really quite violent, especially for then." I guess, but you know, watching it today, I even it took me back. I just didn't expect to see it. And I like the attention to detail. There's a scene where they're on the train, but to the right of the frame, you see scenery going past. So you're getting a sense of speed, a sense of location, and all those sort of things, which, you know, I guess maybe as you know today's audience, you wouldn't necessarily assume they would have incorporated when they were first you know, making film. But oh no, no, absolutely. It's all there. It's just really, really, really good. The final image, of course, is iconic because we have one of the robbers facing us and pointing the gun and just shooting six shots straight at the camera, which I guess must have been pretty scary if you're an audience member back then.
And do you know what I immediately thought of when I saw that scene?
I'm thinking you're thinking of Goodfellas.
Yes, exactly, yep.
Yeah, absolutely. At the end, Joe Pesci does the same thing.
Exactly and, you know, the same thing, yeah.
And of course, Scorsese, you know, Martin Scorsese, a director who very much into his film history. You know, he's the sort of guy that gets movies like this restored. I'm not saying he got this one restored, but he's very much into film restoration. Yeah. You know, and in Goodfellas, what some people would define as his greatest film, you know, he makes reference to the Great Train Robbery, which is quite incredible when you think about it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, as soon as I saw that scene, it you know that Goodfellas just came to mind, and that you know this is one of the things which I'm hoping for is that you know throughout watching all these films from these earlier time periods. You know, we'll probably pick up on things that, you know, in much more recent films that are much more in our, you know, fresh in our minds. And it was pretty great to see things like that. You say the set scene. This was actually shot. It wasn't shot in the West. It was shot on the Delaware and Lackawanna Railroad in New Jersey.
Oh.
It was actually shot on a real train line.
Wow.
Those scenes. So.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, that's pretty great.
Yeah, that's it. And I think it's quite good because you know, we picked two films here and they're very, very different, aren't they? You know, not like they're both, you know, jovial and lighthearted. There's already 1903, 1902, you've got a contrast. You know, people weren't just copying what was popular or whatever. You know, you've got two filmmakers here, you know, really just going out and making their own stories. Yeah,
both, yeah. When you talk about originality, this is it. This is the original. I did. There was at the start, I thought it was quite interesting. It didn't sort of follow it through in the rest of the film. At the start, you've got the criminals wearing black, and on the train, they're the people that they beat up are wearing white, and sort of differentiate visually between them. And it didn't follow that through the rest of the film because there's a point where they get chased by law enforcement who are dressed in dark colors themselves.
Yes.
So I thought that would have been interesting if they'd have kept up that visual continuity to separate the two sets of people. But so that tour bit was a little bit hard to follow in exactly who was doing what.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, really, really interesting to, you know, see this sort of film in it. You know, I love a Western with John Wayne, watching them with my granddad, and you know, to see the first one and see where all these sort of these films came from is you know, it's pretty wonderful. Again, highly recommend it. Takes 10 minutes of your day on YouTube. Definitely worth a watch. I think. Is there anything else you want to say on that?
I just thought of something else. When the good guys are alerted that this train's been robbed, I just like the fact that they were having a dance weren't they? The men and the women were in a
Yeah.
circle doing a dance, rather than just be, I don't know, sat in a room and people automatically rush in and say, "Oh, the train's been robbed, come quickly." No, they're just going about their day. They're having a dance, and then it's interrupted. So again, there's a sense of urgency there. Their everyday life has been interrupted, and they have to go out and catch these guys. It's yeah, simple stuff, but it's effective filmmaking.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's very economical, shall we say. It's straight to the point, and it tells its narrative very well.
It does, yeah. So yeah, I'm glad I watched both of those, for certain. Okay, Marta, so what have we got coming up next week then on the Journey Through Cinema section?
Well, next week the next film in the book is D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation from 1915, which Rowan tells me is over 3 hours long. So that's probably going to be the only film we'll look at for this series next week. I believe next week we're going to be covering Lethal Weapon franchise as well. So that gives us a bit more time to sort of delve into The Birth of a Nation, so that will be next week's journey through cinema.
Fantastic. And I guess we're going from one or a couple of classics there on to Bad Boys 2.
Yes, Bad Boys 2 from the genius mind of Michael Bay, who is our main topic for this week because due to the release of Pain and Gain, which I unfortunately didn't see. So,
Fortunately, mate, trust me, you fortunately didn't see it.
I've seen mixed things. He gets a bad rap, does Mr. Bay. Well, go on then, tell us what your thoughts were on Pain and Gain. No spoilers for me, please.
Okay, sure. So, well, tell you what, let me give you an introduction to Michael Bay. So, Michael Bay, here is a guy who, for better or worse, has really shaped action cinema. He started off making commercials. He did a lot of Victoria's Secrets commercials, so he was already used to
glorifying women.
glossy, sexy, I guess, to the point material. Very much style over substance. He got his big break in 1994, 1994, 1995, sorry, with Bad Boys, produced by Jerry Bruckheimer and then Don Simpson. And really, Michael Bay, he very much goes hand in hand with Jerry Bruckheimer and the high concept movies of the 80s and 90s. But with that, he then kind of spawned his own, very much his own style. No one can deny Michael Bay doesn't have his own style, like it or not. And as I say, with that, he's gone on to seriously shape action cinema, with what people call Bayhem. Now, I don't know if we're going to go through film by film, but Michael Bay is a lot of things. He's a man. He's a director, I say, who has his own style. He doesn't copy anyone else. People copy Michael Bay. Michael Bay doesn't copy other people. But the problem is Michael Bay doesn't know when to rein in the Michael Bay. That's the issue at hand here that I think we're going to constantly come back to as we go through his catalogue of films. I could talk about do you want to talk about his films chronologically, or do you want me to get into Pain and Gain, or what do you like to do?
Let's start chronologically. We haven't taken up that much time already. So,
Okay.
well, Bad Boys was his first film. I haven't seen it for a couple of years, but this was one of my favourite films. I know I'd probably still love it if I put it on now. I think it's just a really fun film.
Yeah.
Very, very quotable, very enjoyable. So I haven't seen it for a few years. I think it's a more, would I be right in saying it's a more restricted Bay?
Yes, for certain. It was the first of his films. Well, it was his first film, but with that, he created what is now the classic Michael Bay shot, which is a slow motion, low angle shot of actors either standing up or rising, looking around as a camera goes around them. He's used it in every single film. And do you know what? In 1995 with Bad Boys, it looked fucking cool as hell. It was awesome,
It was.
wasn't it? Because you hadn't seen anything like it before. You know, here's a guy, and I say action movies are my genre. There's nothing I love more than a good action film, and Bad Boys is a decent action film, but he got the buddy cop movie by the neck, and he shook it, and he said, you know, I'm going to make a glossy, sexy action cop movie, and he did that. It's so high octane, especially at the end. You know, everything just goes boom,
Yeah.
but and it looked so good doing it. That's the thing. There was no, like, you know, crappy sets, or there was no how she's like there was no restriction. You know, he blew things up for real, and he caught it in the grandest way possible.
Yeah, the airport hangar set with
Yeah.
the Porsche chase, you know. Yeah, that's all set very well. Looks good.
You know, and the guy can shoot the shit out of an action sequence. There's no denying it. And Bad Boys, it was his first attempt, and I think with a better script and a bit more a better plot, if you like, you could have had a seriously great buddy cop movie as opposed to what I think was just a, you know, a decent action movie in the end. But I don't blame Michael Bay for that. I think, you know, as his first motion picture, he just, you know, he created something we hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I really like Bad Boys. I think it's, you know, it's definitely it's probably my favorite Michael Bay film.
Really?
Yeah. Well, why? What would you go for?
Well, for me, then his next film is not only, in my opinion, miles away his best film,
Yeah, I would
but
say it's his best. Yeah.
it's also, to me, one of the great action movies,
Which is The Rock.
which is The Rock. I think with this, he had a bigger budget. He had higher caliber of star, because of course, you know, Will Smith wasn't the A-lister he is now. Back in 95, you've got Sean Connery, you've got Nicolas Cage, hot off his best actor win for Leaving Las Vegas. You've got Ed Harris, you've got a iconic location such as Alcatraz, and really, you're working with a kind of a Die Hard-esque plot. You know, this is, you could call it Die Hard and Alcatraz. It isn't, but that's what you could term it as such. But you know, the action in this movie is absolutely top class. It is top notch from beginning to end. I think that there's a car chase in this film through San Francisco, which is one of the best car chases you're gonna see. It's absolutely superb. But
See, I would slightly disagree with that. I
really
like the car chase scene, but
love it.
it's got a lot of that, you know, the Bayisms, really close-up shots.
Yeah.
I mean, at one point we see the Ferrari's door handle for no real reason. And it's, I mean, yeah, you've got the whizzing through the streets of San Francisco, the explosions, the tram.
The tram exploding is fucking awesome.
But yeah, I mean, like I say there's so many quick cut up close shots, which don't do a lot for me. But I mean,
I tell you why they do it for me in this movie is because it was 96 and action films weren't shot like that back then. If this movie came out today, it was shot the same way, it wouldn't have the impact. But back then, to see
Very
a film
normal.
shot like this, through the streets of San Francisco on Alcatraz with all the huge explosions and the genuine tension and the humor, it are just superb. I think this movie is absolutely and utterly superb, and he gets good performances out of his actors for a change as well. I truly love this film. I've seen it countless times,
Yeah, I
and it's
guess.
a, it's a it's a movie that I will constantly revisit.
Yeah, I guess. I probably. I loved the car chase scene when it first came out. I guess I watched it. Rewatched it last year. When Chris, the runner of the iBestPod podcast, invited me to talk about it. And that, I guess, with sort of hindsight, you look at that and. You've got the rest of Michael Bay's films to look back on, which probably affected my judgment a little bit. Looking back on, there's the Michael Bay-isms there. But yeah, really enjoyable film this is. But there's a lot of this is where the caricatures in his films begin to emerge. You've got the gay hairdresser who is so over the top gay that, it's pretty insulting to gay people and to hairdressers, I guess. It's pretty ridiculous. There's that scene where in the hotel where Sean Connery's kicked everyone's ass, he's trying to escape, and he gets in the elevator with the hairdresser, and the hairdresser says, I do you like your haircut? And it's like, oh, come on. Then when he's escaping, they go through the kitchen. You've got the foreign chef, who is this sort of stereotype as well. And then the tram, the black tram guy, and of course he's black, so he's really animated and loud. That's just where. Michael Bay just begins to let loose.
You see, I obviously I know what you're saying about all those characters, but I think for me,
They are fun though. They are fun.
they're adding a bit of light. Well, not so much the cook, but the other two, they're adding a bit of comic relief in this high impact action sequence, which I don't mind. I mean, they're not like their main characters. They're just. It's just a bit of. I see that just as a bit of fun. I don't think there's anything offensive there. And also, I don't think that other directors wouldn't have done the same thing. Maybe the gay hairdresser thing, but I just think that's just personally just a bit of fun. I don't think it's offensive, personally. But
No, I guess.
and you know what?
Again, I
If I
guess again,
think
it's a case of having the rest of his body of work
exactly.
to look at and see how that developed within him and his later films, and got so much worse, that when you do watch this film, it's kind of tainted a little bit with the overall impression you get from his entire body of work, rather than on its own sort of being really that much of a problem.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. I think I just, for me, The Rock is just a movie I have such such love for. I guess maybe I don't see it that way. But if let's say Michael Bay only went on to do bigger and better things, I wonder if you would go back and look at it that way. I imagine. I think
Yeah,
it's
I
because
definitely think
you know what I mean.
what's to
Because his films
come
have got
makes you look
so
at it
much
differently.
worse.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. But you love all the performances in this: Ed Harris, Michael Benn, Bean, or have a
Michael Bean,
Bean. They're great. Nicolas Cage is great. I'll take pleasure in gutting you, boy. I love
Oh,
that. I
fantastic.
love that bit. vintage Cage, absolutely fantastic. It's got a great story as well. That you know that's asking some questions. In the story itself, it's got something to say, really.
Yeah, and I like the Ed Harris character, how he doesn't want to go through with it at the end.
Yeah.
You know, he not say he bottles it, but he realizes what he's doing. It was a threat. He called their bluff, and he wants to admit defeat. And of course, you know, the other Marines are so psychotic. They carry on. But and I love, you know, there's Nick Cage character. He doesn't really become an action hero in the movie. Not like he's kicking Marine ass at the end. He's still very much Stanley Goodspeed.
Yeah.
You know, he remains himself. That's what I really like about it. I think him and Connery make a fantastic team, because Connery, you know, this old guy, and Cage, this nerdy guy, in the middle of all this, you know, shootouts and warfare. Really, really good team, I think they make. And the whole nerve gas thing, that's awesome, I think. Really, really cool. And I like the way it's explained as to what this nerve gas can do. And I really like the opening sequence where they steal it and you see what happens
Yeah.
when that gas is released. And again, and you don't see anything like that until the very end, when he puts it in the guy's mouth and punches him, and it's released in his mouth.
Yeah, that looks great. That's a horrible scene.
It's horrible,
Yeah.
but effective.
Yeah, very effective, as is, you know, when he pumps himself, you know, he injects himself with the adrenaline, when Cage injects himself with the adrenaline.
Yes.
That's like all these sort of movies, they you know, at the time I was 12, or 11. I would have been 12 that October. At that, you know, around about that time, I had a real sort of obsession with nuclear war, which had sort of come from Terminator 2, which I'd, you know, I'd watched since I was like 7. But around that sort of time, it began to sort of freak me out. Which again, you know, this film sort of played into a little bit with the nerve gas, freaking my little childish mind out. So we sort of go from this film to Armageddon.
Yeah, so the success of The Rock, and it was a big success, it's in the top 10 highest grossing films of the year. So the success of The Rock saw him and Bruckheimer move on to quite literally bigger things, Armageddon. And I think this is where the real mayhem begins, because if you look at The Rock, you've got that crazy car chase in the middle. But then what I love about The Rock, so I'm going back
No, that's
again here,
fine. I
sorry
mean,
for
there's still a
touching on
lot to
it.
say about it. It's a very sort of intimate story, isn't it? In
Yeah, and I think what I love about The Rock is, you know, that end sequence, it's constructed really well, because it's not just a massive shootout and a huge action spectacle, explosions upon explosions upon explosions for no reason, and you know, Alcatraz getting flattened and half of San Francisco getting nuked. It's not that at all. It's just very tightly made action sequences, which I think if he were to make The Rock today, San Fran the I'm sure that the action would have gone from Alcatraz on to downtown San Francisco again, and the whole fucking thing would have been flattened. But back then with The Rock, it was very, very tight. I think it's absolutely superb. And then we go on a couple of year time again, and that is when mayhem begins. You see cities getting destroyed. You see huge space stations blowing up just for the sheer spectacle of it all. And his camera never stops moving. And that signaled the beginning of the end in terms of his quality. Well, what's your thoughts, Martin?
I like Armageddon.
Really?
Yeah,
Don't get
I'm
me wrong,
not going to
I don't
deny
hate
that.
it. I don't hate it. I think it's fine, but I think it's I do think that's where it all started. his obsession with destroying stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I say I, you know, I love these kind of space stories. Anything to do with space, I'm sold into immediately. So, you know, I like that part of it. But yeah, I genuinely enjoy this film. There's not, I mean, I know there's probably a lot wrong with it, but
Yeah.
it's something that, I mean, I haven't watched it for years, to be honest, but it's definitely something I could put on and just absolutely enjoy from beginning to end. You know,
Yeah, that's
you know, a big fan of Bruce Willis, you know, Ben Affleck, you know, I like Ben Affleck in this, and it's just, it's got a good cast. It's got a great cast.
the real fantastic cast.
You know, Billy Bob Thornton, Affleck, Tyler, Steve Buscemi, William Fichtner,
Oh, it's got Michael Clarke Duncan.
Michael Clarke Duncan, you know, all these supporting characters, you know, they're just absolutely brilliant. There's so much humor and heart that I feel was in the film, because of all these, you know, these rough and tough, you know, average Joes. They're, you know, they're quite, they're very endearing.
Yeah, so I like it. I just feel that yeah, that was very much the catalyst for what would be his go-to thought process, I guess, for his next films. But yeah, you know, say Armageddon is fun, and it is good family fun as well. But that's the thing. There's nothing nasty about it. There's nothing sexist or just, you know, nothing bad that leaves a bad taste in the mouth. It is damn good fun. I think it's over long, whereas I think The Rock justifies its 2 hour plus length, whereas I don't personally think this one does. But you know, it's a spectacle film of the highest order. There's no doubt about that. And I think, again, you know, back in '98, he was showing you stuff you hadn't seen before. Again, he was shaping action movies with, you know, the destruction of New York, those fantastic shots of various landmarks getting destroyed. There's a scene where I think Paris gets
Yeah,
completely
Paris,
wiped out.
Shanghai.
Shanghai, yeah.
Yeah, they look, you know, they look pretty great.
Yeah. They still look great now, that's the thing. It still looks good now. I remember actually I think it's a shot where the Twin Towers get taken out, don't they? Or partly taken out,
Yes.
which is quite spooky, considering, you know, what happened a few years after.
Yeah. I like, you know, I think I say you say it's good family fun. I think there's a lot of heart there, you know, between the Bruce Willis, you know, the triangle between Bruce Willis and his daughter Liv Tyler and her boyfriend Ben Affleck, who's like, you know, a surrogate son to him. I think there's a lot of heart from there, which is backed up by all the supporting, you know, the supporting cast. I love, you know, I love Steve Buscemi in this as Rock Hound. I love it when he has his, you know, his breakdown. He's pretending to be, you know, Slim Pickens from Doctor Strangelove when he's sitting on the nuke. That's great.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you say, it's where, you know, the sort of Bayesians come out. You know, his character picks up a gun and starts shooting the asteroid just for no real reason, and then it's I guess I would probably agree that you could shorten, you could probably take up. I know it brings into a character which, you know, he provides a few funny moments, but there's no real need for the Russian cosmonaut to be there,
Exactly.
other than to get your explosion
Quota.
in, yeah, on the Russian on the space station. That's all that really provides, isn't it? So.
Yes, indeed. But as you say, yeah, it's good, large scale blockbuster family fun. Despite its, I guess, you know, flaws in the plot or whatever. I don't dislike the film at all. But it did light the touch paper.
It's got Keith David in it as well. He plays
Which
Jim.
role is he?
He's the general at NASA.
Ah, okay.
I you know, I like him. He's I like watching things that he's in. I like him as a, you know, as an actor. But yeah, I really enjoyed Armageddon. I'm not gonna deny that.
So is that your favourite Bay then?
No, I'd probably say Bad Boys is.
Bad Boys still, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. But
I'd say they're pretty closely tied. But then,
so let's say, so if you've seen Earth partly destroyed, you've seen San Francisco partly destroyed, and you've seen a plane hangar blown to shit, I think Michael Bay then becomes the obvious choice to direct a story about the, and well, one of the most prolific attacks on America in its history, and the turning point in the Second World War, obviously.
Definitely. Absolutely.
Let's get it straight. Pearl Harbor's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Don't tell me otherwise, Martin. Come
no,
on.
No, yeah. It's pretty fucking awful.
It is atrocious. And it's strange, because when I saw the cinema, and I didn't hate it, but of course, this is 2001. And if I saw it today at the cinema, I would tear into it big time. Because obviously I see things differently now. But from a technical perspective, the bombing on Pearl Harbor, I think at a first viewing, is really quite amazing. Genuinely, it looks stunning. But then you have to think to yourself, this is based on a real event. This actually happened. Real American soldiers lost their lives, and he is showing a CGI missile dropping from the sky, landing on a plane. He's just glorifying this tragic event. And it's, when you look at it that way, it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
There's a great, that great song in Team America, you know, about,
yeah, Pearl Harbor,
you know,
sucks.
Yeah. And you know, like Pearl Harbor missed the point, and it really did miss the point of that story.
Yeah. It's shocking. And not only is it, I guess, offensive to the, you know, the reality of what happened. Aside from that, the love story in it is absolutely awful. Obviously, they were trading in on the whole Titanic thing, where you have, you know, a love story at the centre of a real life disaster, which they do in this. Josh Hartnett doesn't act very well and hasn't acted very well in his entire career. He is just atrocious. You got Kate Beckinsale. She's not doing much for me, I'm afraid. She looks very nice, but she's not got a lot going on in the acting department. And you've got these people are trying to, you know, hold this film together. And it's just an utter disaster. I don't really have much more to say about it, mate. I don't know about yourself. It pisses me off that Jerry Bruckheimer was involved in the film, because, you know, like his films or not, he's a very influential filmmaker. You know, he gets shit made, quite simply, and he makes a lot of money from his movies. And some of his films have been absolutely fantastic, The Rock being one of them, Armageddon being a good example. But how Jay Bruckheimer would want to make this movie with this director is really quite obscene, I think.
Yeah, don't really want to talk about it too much. I mean, no. I think everyone pretty knows this is an awful film. But
yeah,
you know, I've seen people talk about it on Facebook and Twitter that I know from real life, and they don't seem to hate it at all. But it's the kind of shit that people will often eat up.
Exactly. Yeah, I just think as soon as you think to yourself that it's shot this way and it was based on real events, I mean, it's shocking. Imagine, you know, if he shot Saving Private Ryan, how different the film would have been.
Yeah.
You know, same screenplay, but Michael Bay directing it. Horror, it could have been a disaster. Obviously, thankfully, he didn't. But, you know, that's the difference. It's just that weird obsession he has with almost pornographic sensibilities. And obviously, we'll come to that, I guess, with some of the later films. But yeah, but Pearl Harbor, you know, say real American soldiers. Many, 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 many people died, and he's shooting it like a fucking music video.
Yeah.
It's shocking. And then, you know, it's a massive fucking hit. That's a problem. A massive hit. I think it was the second biggest opening weekend of all time when it was made in 2001. So, you know, it makes a ton of money, and that then gives him
Off a lot
license.
of good faith of Armageddon, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think anyone walked into Pearl Harbor thinking it was going to be as bad as it was, because he's made three good movies before that.
And then he makes two horrors,
Yeah. I
which
mean, oh my God, Bad Boys 2. Honestly. And then it's weird because Bad Boys 2, I cannot deny that as much as I hate it, and I do hate it, that the extended chase sequence with the car transporter is absolutely frigging awesome.
Yeah, don't disagree. You know, that is great.
And again, you know, he is changing the face of action movies with that, because he created or helped create cameras which could be like smashed into. So I watched some of the extras on it, and he said things like he wants to shoot the movie in a way that if there was a cameraman actually filming it, the cameraman would die. That's what he said. You know, so when you see those cars smashing into cameras, obviously there's no one operating that camera. If there were, they would die. He wants that visceral impact with Bad Boys 2. And it's a very violent thing when you think about it. And it's so, the editing is unlike any of his other movies up until this point. He really changed direction with Bad Boys 2. And it just ended up being an experiment in how to shoot action. Because as good as that truck chase is, you know, the whole film just becomes a series of individual action sequences for him to just show how much he can destroy things. And put together, it's an atrocious film. I mean, you know, forget the acting and the villains and all the jokes about rats having sex and all that sort of stuff. The action sequences on their own are really quite good, but put together in the film, they have little impact, which is quite astounding when you think about it.
It's like it's just not as funny as the first one either. Just not at all.
No, I mean, it's just loses. It's, you know, the Bad Boys was fun, but in this, I hated those two characters. There's nothing likable about either of them. And what I also don't like is in the first movie, yeah, they bicker and stuff, blah, 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 fine. But in the second film, they haven't progressed. You
No.
know, they haven't moved on. Their relationship is exactly the same.
If not
There's
sort
no
of louder
development.
and.
Yeah, louder and nastier and more arrogant, and all the negatives is what they put into Bad Boys 2. It's just a horrible, nasty film. And yeah, I've got really no more to say about it other than what, you know, watch the action sequences on YouTube and you'll have a fantastic time, but do not watch them as part of the film, because they can't help the film to be a success. It's a horrible film.
And then his next film, The Island, wasn't
Oh, good.
too great either.
No, I saw it the once.
Yeah, I saw it once at the cinema as well. I've never seen it since.
Terrible. And what really annoyed me about that is, do you remember there's that sequence where he copies the truck chase in Bad Boys 2? So in Bad Boys 2, you got the cars being flipped onto the highway. And in this one, doesn't he like, isn't it just like giant metal wheels or something? Like these huge barrels or something like that that are being pushed off the back of a truck. It's the exact same thing, but with different objects.
No, I can't recall that, but
yeah, that's what I remembered it. That's all I remember that about that film.
When did this come out? I mean, this was
2005.
It's been 8 years. I saw it once at the cinema, so 8 years. Can't really remember too much about it, other than, you know, I remember being utterly bored.
Yeah, it's
by
a terrible picture. This was his first film not working with Jay Bruckheimer. He moved over to, was this DreamWorks? I think it might be DreamWorks. And I think him and Bruckheimer had a falling out because obviously, you know, Bruckheimer brought Bay to fame. He got him all these huge projects. They were making shed loads of money together, even though the films were decreasing in quality. And then, you know, he switches up teams, makes the island, and it flops. It was by far, well, I think, because Bad Boys didn't do a hell of a lot of money, but I don't think it was expected to. Whereas by this point in his career, The Island was expected to be another massive hit, but it wasn't.
And then he gets given Transformers, which... well, I liked it at the time. I could put it on now and enjoy it for what it is. But, you know, it's a bit of a clusterfuck at times.
To say the least. And again, I'll go back to my same point. Again, he's shaping the action movie because I don't like Transformers, any of them, but there is stuff in this first movie that blows my mind to think how they filmed it and how they came up with these special effects and designed these action sequences. You know, absolutely stunning stuff that he creates. The problem is each action sequence is about, you know, 50% too long. And he just wears you down with boom, bang, smash, crash, boom. He just grinds you down to
there's
a
just
point
stuff
you can't
going,
take anymore.
Yeah, there's just stuff going everywhere. Close up after close up, you just can't. Oh. You can't tell which. The Transformers. It's a film about Transformers, but you never get to really know who any of them are. When
no idea.
You know, when the fights are happening, you can't tell really who's winning. What's actually going on? The Shia LaBeouf character is just, you know, highly annoying. You know, the objectification of Megan Fox. Yeah, do you know what? I could probably put it on and not enjoy it, actually. I take that back. Now I've reminded myself.
And it's so long as well, isn't it?
It goes on and on.
Exactly. And you think there's so much crap you can cut out of that movie. And if you cut it out, you could genuinely have an awesome summer action picture, but instead you just got just a borderline offensive assault on the senses.
Yeah, it could have been a really great movie. It could have, you know, and I compare, you know, we both didn't like Pacific Rim. And whilst they are sort of very much different, it's just the same sort of empty robot smashing robot.
Yeah.
You know, Pacific Rim, you know, give a lot more credit to for what it attempted to do. But I don't see a real, very much a difference between them at all.
You know, I'd sooner watch Transformers than Pacific Rim because, quite simply, Transformers did it first. You know, when it comes to large-scale, CGI-driven action sequences that is the norm, you know, these days... You know, they're all copying Transformers. They're all doing that because that's the winning formula. That's what people apparently want to see. And I'd rather go back to the first Transformers than watch any of these copies because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't get any better than what you see in that 2007 film I don't particularly like all of it, but that for me is the best it's going to get.
And the sequel
didn't
get any better. It was pretty awful.
Yeah, I think it's truly, truly, truly awful. I'm talking, you know, 1 out of 10 material here. I've only seen it once. I saw it at the cinema, of course, like everyone, opening day.
I actually own it, but I never saw it at the cinema. I bought it. Don't know why I've still got it.
Actually, going back to Transformers, I bought the Blu-ray, even though I don't like the film. I bought the Blu-ray when I first got my Blu-ray players because, you know, if you're going to watch a Blu-ray when you first get a player and you want to show off your sound system, then let's be honest, Transformers is one of the movies to do it with. it looks absolutely awesome on Blu. That's for certain. But yeah, sorry, going back to Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen, it's just an awful film. It's everything that was wrong with Transformers turned up to 10.
Yeah, and you know, becomes quite offensive.
Yeah, oh yeah, this is the one where it gets highly offensive to women and race and everything. And you got to remember, this is supposed to be a family movie. This is family summer entertainment.
Yeah. You know, they introduce Isabel Lucas as the girl Transformer who somehow the Transformers can shape like people.
How does that make any sense?
No idea. and the objectification of her, and it's so bad. So bad. And similarly, well, I went to watch Transformers Dark of the Moon. I've never seen it. I went to watch it this week. Mm. So that I could say I'd watched every title of Bay's. I watched the first 8 minutes and turned it off. There's obviously at the start of that film. Have you seen it?
Yeah. I saw it opening day.
fall on you. you know, that whole sequence on the moon. It's all shot so badly.
Really badly.
But what made me turn it off is when it cuts from that to present day. The first thing you see is just a woman's ass, hanging out from under a male shirt as she walks up the stairs, and I just turned it off. I wasn't going to put myself through it.
I can tell you, it gets worse. I mean, remember this is the film that stars bloody John Malkovich and Frances McDormand. They're both in this movie. It's mental. To think they would lower themselves to this shit. Honestly, mate, it gets a lot worse. I mean, this time I think it's Chicago that gets flattened. But it's just the same thing. It's just a massive, long action sequence of everything just blowing up. But I do think you should seek out one particular sequence in the film, because it's possibly the best thing Bay's ever done. And the reason it's so good is because there's not a Transformer in sight in this sequence. And what it is, and it pisses me off, because if this, you could put this sequence in, say, a Mission Impossible or a James Bond movie, and it would be like the climactic scene. Right, but in Transformers 3, it's just part of a bigger action sequence. Anyway, you should check out mine, because they're in this skyscraper, and the skyscraper has been attacked, and it, like half of it or the top quarter, whatever, is slowly collapsing, and everything's sliding from like left to right, and they're all grabbing onto posts and pillars and stuff to try and save themselves, and they have to then get off and go to another part of the building, and it's really, really good. It's about 4 minutes long, so not a Transformer in sight, not a robot in sight, just humans, just sets, and it's awesome. Really, really good stuff. And then as soon as a Transformer shows up, it goes back to shit again. Yeah, so if you can catch it on YouTube, I'll try and send you a link after this.
Oh, yeah, cool.
You should watch it because it's quality. And if he could do that, that sort of, you know, quality action, again, he's capable of it. We've seen that with The Rock. We've seen that with Bad Boys. But he just has no interest, I think, which is a real shame. I say in any other movie, that would be the climactic point. But in this, it's just something he put in there, which is such a shame.
So then we'll move on to Pain and Gain, which obviously I haven't seen. So you weren't a fan then?
I wasn't a fan. I gave it 2 stars in my review, which means it's better than Transformers 2 and 3 and The Island and Bad Boys 2 and Pearl Harbor. So it's a step up from everything post the Armageddon. I think the first hour of the movie is actually quite good. You know, Bay does his damnedest to fuck it up, in all fairness, but not even he can balls it up because it's moving at a good pace. Mark Wahlberg is really, really good in his role, as is Dwayne Johnson in the first hour. It's a bit nasty, but it comes across as a real black comedy, and I took it that way. There's a whole satire on chasing the American dream and these bodybuilders who are up their ass in steroids. They just want what other people have got. So they kidnap this guy and they want him to sign over all his wealth and his fortune to them. But he won't do it because he's stubborn. And they kidnap him and they torture him a bit to make him sign over the deeds to his house and everything else. And it's funny. There were some lines in it that genuinely made me laugh out loud, which, you know, a lot of comedies don't. Most of the trademark Michael Bay shots are kept to a minimum. They say the camera doesn't really stop moving, but it's not too noticeable, I didn't think, in the first half of this film. A better director was certainly needed, because as the film progresses, so into the second half, I think Michael Bay either loses track of the satire, or it becomes apparent to the audience that he never understood the satire, or he had no interest in making this a satire, because it just ends up glorifying the violence. Because this is based on a true story, remember? So everything, like Pearl Harbor, so everything we're seeing happened in real life. But he just makes it look like it's just a comedy. We're supposed to be laughing at all this violence. Once they start killing people and stuff, it gets really, really nasty. But I don't think Michael Bay is in on the joke. I think he just wants us to revel in the nastiness, which isn't the point. If you've got a movie like, say, because you touched on it earlier, Bernie, in that movie, you know, bad things happen, but we're not supposed to, I don't think we're supposed to laugh at it. We're supposed to, I guess, really maybe feel a bit sorry for Bernie or whatever. But in this movie, we're supposed, in Bay's mind, we're supposed to just laugh at when people's